From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Reverend Jesse Jackson is making headlines for a derogatory comment made about Barack Obama. Jackson appeared during the weekend on the Fox News show Fox and Friends. During a break, when he thought the mic was out, he said he wanted to cut off, and here we are paraphrasing, Senator Obama's manhood. Why? Because according to Jackson, quote, Barack's been talking down to black people, end quote, on faith-based issues. The comments were broadcast yesterday on the O'Reilly Factor. Jackson has since said he's sorry to Obama, and a campaign spokesperson says the senator has accepted the apology. We were able to speak to Reverend Jackson after the news about the remark was leaked to the press, but before Fox broadcast it. And even before I had a chance to ask the Reverend a question, he launched into an explanation.
The reason I chose to make a statement today publicly, I have real passion for this campaign. I've supported it since before Barack even announced, for example. And I do not want a soundbite out of context to interrupt a broader conversation and a very positive message he has going to our nation. When I said that some of the messages aimed at the black church could be considered talking down the blacks, my appeal really was the moral content of the message, to not only deal with the personal and moral responsibility of black males, but to deal with the collective moral responsibility of government and the public policy, the private public dialogue. And so I want to get in front of this because I do not want any diversion from his record-setting positive campaign.
I want to make sure that I have things straight. According to the news reports that we have at the time we're talking to you, you used a term for the male anatomy in describing
that was when the real, I really was talking with Dr. Reed Tuckson, and he asked about the messages lately aimed at the black churches, which had a lot to do with moral responsibility. And I said they must not be just talking down to blacks or the blacks only. And then I said something pejorative and embarrassing personally. But the message remains the same, that we need a broader message to include the crisis of jobs out, guns and drugs, and we need a broader message to restructure our economy to put America back to work. That's my passion, and my passion for this campaign remains undaunted, and I look forward to his success, and I'll work for him continuously this fall in the campaign.
But do you think his Father's Day speech was a sister soldier moment where he essentially criticized poor and working class black people to please white voters?
Well, Psalms interpreted that way, and I was concerned it would not be interpreted that way. For example, black community infant mortality rates are highest, the life expectancy is shorter, the most underfunded schools, the most teachers of children under 3 years of experience, 2.3 million Americans in jail, a million are black, in part sentencing disparities. A whole range of what Dr. King would call structural inequalities that must be addressed. And while the moral lesson is appropriate, I give it all the time myself, we're going to have to invest in abandoned rural and urban America in order to break these disparity gaps and put all of America on an even playing field.
Many of the smartest people in the world, the most engaged people in the world, are also linguistically colorful. And sometimes you have to backtrack a bit. On that note, have you called the senator or spoken with the senator since?
I've spoken with his staff. Mm-hmm. Our friendship remains intact. And I do not want anything that was said in any guise to distract from his message and our support for his campaign.
Now, during the 84 campaign, you called New York Hymie Town while speaking with a black Washington Post reporter, and you got a lot of heat for that. So this, I understand, occurred when you spoke when you thought a mic was closed. So what have you learned about interacting with us in the media from all this stuff?
Well, you do your job, and I respect that, and I do mine. And for the most part, we try to keep the hope alive. We try to make the country better. And we're not going to lose that message. And what a great moment, a redemptive moment in America, a rehabilitative moment. And I'm glad to be a part of it. And a 54-year race, Barack has running a fast last lap and moving on to victory, and we support it.
Finally, when you think about your role in the 2008 election, how would you describe it?
Work on voter registration, voter mobilization, education, coalition building, work together to help end the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, reinvest in America, to convince young America that they really do have the power to change the course of the country, that we must have a renewed, a multiracial, multicultural coalition. These are the themes that I revolve my work around, and I intend to be pushing them real hard this summer and fall.
And do you think you'd go out on the stump with him if he wanted you to, or does he want you to?
Whatever, for example, that he wants, you know, he must make that decision, you know, as to who, you know, that campaign, you know, you have consultants, you have advisors, you have surrogates, you have supporters. I'm a strong supporter and have been so since before he announced, and I will continue supporting because I believe he represents the right side of history for all of America and really for the world.
Well, Reverend Jackson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Reverend Jackson is the founder and president of the Rainbow Push Coalition. He spoke to us about remarks he made about Senator Barack Obama. And for analysis, we turn to Christopher Bracey. He's a professor of law, African and African-American studies at George Washington University School of Law. He's also the author of Saviors or Sellouts, The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism from Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice. Thanks for joining us again.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be on.
So, there has been so much traffic on the internet, so many people talking about this. Reverend Jackson says he wants to get out there and apologize early, but is this a permanent mark against his place in history?
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, Reverend Jackson has been an integral part of the civil rights movement since early on, and he used the metaphor of a race, and a 54-year race, and Barack Obama is running the last leg of the race. But what appears to be the case in this situation is that Reverend Jackson isn't fully willing to hand off that baton, stand down and cheer as Obama runs. He wants to be involved, and in this particular moment, his involvement seems to have somewhat tragic consequences.
Let's start with the atmospherics of the issue. What does it say about the relationship between Obama and the civil rights establishment, not just Reverend Jackson, but other people of that age or from that background?
Well, I think what it tells us is that, to a certain extent, the civil rights establishment is a little bit worried about passing the baton of power. I mean, here Barack Obama is coming into a power position where he's going to be able to govern. This is the dream and aspiration of many black folks of our generation and generations past. And so they rightly want to be involved with that. They rightly want to put their stamp on that legacy. They want to be able to influence the role of governance in the 21st century. And yet it's unclear whether they fully understand, I'm talking now about the civil rights generation, whether they fully understand the differences in style and approach that are represented by 21st century black politics.
Now, oddly enough, or not at all, because it's a small world, Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. is a national co-chair of Obama's campaign. He said in a statement, quote, "He should keep hope alive and any personal attacks and insults to himself." So what's that father-son dynamic?
That's a harsh statement. I mean, you know, some of us were expecting, I mean, because this is a very delicate matter for Barack Obama. On the one hand, he wants to keep those civil rights establishment figures behind him, supporting him throughout this general election period. But at the same time, he knows well that if he can create a little bit of distance with Jesse Jackson, he may be able to pull on more moderate Democrats, white and black, and maybe even some moderate Republicans. But Jesse Jackson Jr. seems to have taken the lead and seemed particularly angry and personally offended by what his father had done. And it suggests that the relationship there is somewhat fractured as well.
Let's go deeper linguistically into this. When at the time that I spoke with Reverend Jackson, and this was yesterday, we believed, knowing what we did, we being most of the press, that he had said that Senator Obama had emasculated himself. As it turned out, the phrase was much rougher and much more, you know, I want to blank, blank, blank. Is there a difference between those two ways, neither of them particularly nice, of parsing out lack of manhood?
Well, you know, I actually read that slightly differently. When I heard about the specific comments and the castration and sort of the anger in which it was delivered, even though it was a whisper, I immediately began to think back historically about, you know, the ways in which powerful black men or uppity black men were punished. And it was, you know, the threat of castration was very real in the 19th century. And there's a moment of irony that Jesse Jackson would want to assert his power, his relevance to Barack Obama's campaign by placing himself over Barack, in a sense, and suggesting that he is the man and also capable of taking Barack's manhood away.
Coming up this weekend, we have the start of the NAACP's annual convention, and although he has not started yet, Ben Jealous is the incoming president. He's 35. He's going to be the youngest president ever of the NAACP. We seem to be seeing a generational shift overall. Is there going to be blood on the floor, metaphorically, as this shift happens?
You know, there are going to be some rough spots. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, I think right now that, no pun intended, the NAACP is in a state of crisis when it comes to young folks. You know, our generation doesn't view the NAACP as particularly relevant in the way that our parents' generation and our parents' parents' generation did. And so there is going to have to be a revitalization of the NAACP. And I think that the civil rights establishment are going to have to stand down and allow the young folks to articulate their vision for that organization. And there are going to be some feelings hurt. There are going to be some criticisms levied against the civil rights establishment. But I think they're going to have to hold their tongue a little bit this weekend and allow this to run its course.
Finally, and very briefly, what does Reverend Jackson need to do to ensure that he goes down in history as someone who has accomplished many things and not a bitter old man?
Well, I mean, I don't think that this looks to tarnish Jeff Jackson's overall legacy. There are many events prior to this that would have tarnished his legacy more generously than the comment against Obama. I think the main thing that Jesse Jackson needs to do is begin to act more strategically, more supportive behind the scenes, less open on the microphone, more grassroots organizing, and making those connections to ensure success for Barack Obama in November.
All right, Christopher, thanks.
My pleasure.
Christopher Bracey is a professor of law, African and African American studies at George Washington University School of Law. He's the author of Saviors or Sellouts, The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism. And we want to know what you think about Jackson's comments. To share your thoughts, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Last summer, children around the country rallied and urged lawmakers to support comprehensive health care for kids. They were taking part in the Children's Defense Fund's National Day of Social Action. Tomorrow, more than 800 children across the nation are planning to do it again. The effort is spearheaded by Marion Wright Edelman. She founded the nation's strongest voice for children and families, the Children's Defense Fund. Marion Wright Edelman, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So give us a brief outline of the state of children's health care today.
Well, it's a disgrace that this rich nation has 9.4 million uninsured children, that 90% of those children live in working families, playing by the rules, cannot get health care. And so we have just been so insistent that it is time to see that every child gets born with good prenatal care and that every child gets coverage, and not just the third that the Democrats wanted to cover last year when the CHIP bill came up for reauthorization. But you can't leave 6 million children out of a health care fold. And so the children, we have 9,000 children in freedom schools around the country, but many of them are going to go out tomorrow, including Washington, D.C., and in their state capitals, and go see their senators and congressmen and say it is time to cover every child, not some. God did not make two classes of children.
Tell me about tomorrow's Day of Social Action. What specifically is it going to look like, and where is it going to be?
Tomorrow is a civic participation day. They will be going to see their senators and congressmen and others marching to their offices and saying that it is time for every child to have health care. All should have the same benefits. All should be able to be born with good health care. They are going to tell them how upset they are that children died last year from dental abscesses that just didn't get treatment because children fell through the bureaucratic cracks. And while all of us at the Children's Defense Fund want universal coverage for everybody in America, which is long overdue, children can't wait while we debate for another 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years for universal coverage for everybody. And so next year they're going to be considering again the funding for the Child Health Insurance Program, but we want to make sure that any consideration of that program will say we're going to cover every child right now.
Can you give us a story of how a child has been affected by health issues?
The case that I like to use from Texas that broke my heart, because this is a mother that did everything right, is the mother in the family of Devontae Johnson, who lived in Houston and whose mother herself has multiple sclerosis, but she knew her child had kidney cancer. And she started very early on to try to renew his health insurance under Medicaid, but she got caught in the bureaucratic morass between Medicaid and CHIP, and so for months, despite many, many efforts in doing everything right, reapplying and reapplying, the papers keep getting lost, it ended up that he got cut off, and he went for 4 months without health coverage, and he died from kidney cancer because his coverage had been wrongfully denied. That just should not happen. And one of the things that we're trying to do to prevent these kinds of tragedies in the future is to have one child health program so that there are not two bureaucracies and they can't fall through the cracks. But Devontae Johnson was one of those heartbreaking stories that is a preventable death that we hope will never happen again.
Senator Clinton is no longer a candidate for president, but while she was campaigning, she regularly mentioned you as one of her mentors. And she used to be on the board of your organization, but you had a bit of a falling out over welfare reform. And so how do you connect with her today? And have you worked with her subsequently on any political initiatives, whether it's during this election or previously?
Well, we don't take positions in political campaigns, but we have been good friends for 30 years. And she not only was on our board, but she chaired our board for a number of years. And we continue to work with her. Nobody agrees on everything. And we certainly did disagree on the welfare issue. But we continue to work together on children's health and on child care and on a lot of early childhood issues. And we'll continue to do that. And I know that she's going to be a very strong voice supporting Senator Obama, but supporting coverage for everybody. And I hope that, you know, she's going to continue to be that strong voice for health coverage for all children, so that we remain friends and we remain allies. And I'm very grateful for her service over the years and look forward now to a concerted voice by all the presidential candidates and whoever's elected president to say the first thing we're going to do is to make sure that every child gets a healthy start in America, and I'm sure she will be among them.
Along those same lines, the two major party contenders left, John McCain and Barack Obama, both have their takes on health care. John McCain's plan provides credits of $5,000 for families in order to buy insurance, and the Obama plan mandates coverage for children and requires that employers share the cost of their employees' health coverage. Do either of these get at what you are trying to do from your perspective for the children that you are championing?
Well, Senator McCain's plan certainly would not. Senator Barack Obama's plan comes much, much closer, and I do hope that he is going to provide a strong voice next year for health care for every child and simplified bureaucracy. But I think that, you know, his approach comes much closer. But I just want to make sure that children don't get held hostage to broader universal health coverage debates while they need health care right now. So I hope he will be a strong voice. And I like the fact that he would mandate it for all children, but we need to do it now, because children really can't wait. They are being born now, and they need to, you know, have their mental health needs dealt with now. And so, but he comes much closer to being what we want.
Finally, we were trying to speak to you sometime earlier, and your representatives told us that you were working on a memoir. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're writing and when you expect it to pass through the various gates of publishing and show up on our shelves?
Well, it will show up on your shelves on September 23rd, 2008, and it's not a memoir, it's a series of letters. 11 letters, one of which is to Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and others to parents and to young people and to my grandchildren. We wanted to look at the 40 years since Dr. King's death, since the Children's Defense Fund Parent Organization began during the Poor People's Campaign, and to see how much progress we had made on Dr. King's warnings about racism and poverty and excessive materialism and militarism. So That Dr. King's letter, I think, was the impetus, and it says that we've made a lot of progress, but we've got a lot of way to go. But I also try to talk about the need for adults to step up to the plate and to get our priorities straight. So it's a call to action to dismantle the cradle to prison pipeline, to end child poverty. So I hope on September 23rd you'll go in. The name of the book is called The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small. Charting a course for the next generation. And I hope that parents and religious leaders and young people and our public leaders and those of us who are citizens who care about the direction of our nation will find a way to be useful in building a citizen movement to change the priorities of our nation so that all of our children can have a healthy and safe start in life.
Well, we hope you'll come on and talk to us about the book.
I'll look forward to it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Marion Wright Edelman is founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund. This month, we're taking a closer look at jazz, and today we're digging into jazz as social protest. This art form was forged by social struggle. Take an emancipated and transplanted race, then put them up against discrimination during rapid industrialization. That cultural cauldron produced music which criticized segregation with candor, sadness, and humor. Right now with us, we've got Robert O'Mealy. He's the Zora Neale Hurston Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University and founder and former director of the Center for Jazz Studies. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Farai. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. And the little bit of music we heard was part of Louis Armstrong's Black and Blue. Some people saw him as that man who smiled, a man too carefree for politics. But was he really?
Well, it's fascinating that all this time later, Armstrong still is part of the cultural landscape. Many people did wonder about that handkerchief and the too ready smile on the Ed Sullivan Show and other late night TV programs or family time TV programs. But behind that smile was a man who didn't miss anything and who took political stands when it counted. And the song that we're hearing a bit of in the background, What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue, was for its time a very, very forthright statement about being black in America and being mad as hell about the injustices that brought you.
Well, let's listen to a little bit more.
How will it end? Ain't got a friend, my only sin. Is in my skin. What did I do to be so black and blue?
So how did social protest figure into the creativity of Armstrong and early jazz musicians?
I have to say that each jazz musician would have his or her own story here, but despite that fact, there is within the music itself an urgency and a will to celebrate a community. And the will to celebrate a community, because it stems from the black community originally, itself is a political statement. And so that, you know, someone like Jelly Roll Morton might be doing the Kansas City Wild Man Blues that can just be a party song, but because that song in its form is saying we as black people are here, and what we do has beauty and it matters to us, if not to anybody else, that in itself is a political urgency that scared the dickens out of many other people. So you got protests against the music that was so celebratory of a people right from the beginning. And I might add that you also had very early on, that Armstrong song is 1929, blues singers and then jazz players too, coming straight out and saying, what did I do to be so black and blue?
You know, some of these jazz artists dealt in a mainly segregated world. Duke Ellington had an element of social protest, quiet social protest, even at the segregated Cotton Club. He often simply said, I make black music, and didn't want to use jazz. But then you think of Billie Holiday, who made a name for herself at Cafe Society, one of the first integrated clubs. The song Strange Fruit was written by a white musician, but it's very much hers. Let's listen to a bit.
southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
You know, there's been an entire book written just about this song and her performance of it. Obviously deeply evocative. How was it received at the time?
When it was first brought to Billie Holiday's record company, they refused it because they felt it was too political for them. They were afraid of their southern listeners, and so she couldn't record it there. So there's one response. And then she went to a small record store owner who had a record label as well, Commodore Records with Milt Gabler, and he put it out, and it became an underground hit, and then one of those hits that just lasts for through the century. The immediate response was that for lefties in New York City, white and black, you wanted to make it down to Cafe Society, the downtown nightclub, to hear her sing this wonderful, disturbing protest song. So it was received with resistance at first, but then celebrated by the resistors.
Well, there's another artist who has, there's so many of these artists who have this incredible fire. Nina Simone, legendary vocalist, often performed her incendiary Mississippi Goddamn to rapt audiences. Let's take a listen.
Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail, black cat cross my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine, we all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there, I've even stopped believing in prayer.
You know, we recently spoke with a singer who goes by the name Simone, who is Nina Simone's daughter, and a wonderful artist in her own right, and she said that she believes that her mother sang Mississippi Goddamn so hard that she actually changed her own voice, kind of broke her voice, and it had a lower tenor after she did this song. What do you hear when you listen to that song?
Well, that first of all, is a wonderful story. Nina Simone says in her autobiography that song was inspired by her rage at the death of the murder of Medgar Evers and the killing of those four girls in Birmingham, Alabama. She says writing that song brought her through. She was a church girl, as you know, and now a church woman. And she said that just as they say in church that you can get the spirit and really see things, she says writing that song was for her the kind of coming through as a political agent. For the first time, she said she felt what it meant to be black in America, and that we were in the midst of a very, very hot warfare. And she wasn't going to get a gun out, but she was going to use her language and her music to make her point. And I do hear the change in voice as well. She starts as a piano player, classically trained and singing in a beautiful lyrical voice, which she kept all her life, but there's a toughness that we hear later that's more associated in my mind with the jazz tradition, with the kind of raw edge that you're going to take me just as I am. With all of the anger that's implied in that voice.
We're going to go to a break in a second, but before we do, is there any generalization, quickly, you can make about the differences between male jazz musicians' protest and female jazz musicians' protest?
I would say it, and I would quote my colleague, Farrah Griffin, and say that the women have to be more concerned about the position of women in our society. And in their music, I hear that, following Billie Holiday's example, we have to be free, but we have to also remember that we're not going to be anybody's prostitutes as musicians. We're not going to have agents that use us. We're going to be our own free agents.
All right. Well, Robert, stay with us. We are talking about jazz and social protest. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're back talking about the history of social protest in jazz with Robert O'Mealy. He's the Zora Neale Hurston Professor of English at Columbia University. Welcome back, and let's jump in again with Nina Simone. We were just talking about her. And another one of her songs is called Backlash Blues. It was written by her friend, the poet Langston Hughes.
Mr. Backlash, Mr. Backlash, just who do you think I am? You raise my taxes, freeze my wages, and send my son to Vietnam. You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools? Mr. Backlash, I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue.
Now, that song was included on a Nina Simone compilation released in April called the Nina Simone Protest Anthology, which suggests that there's more than one or two songs that have a protest theme. Let's talk about this song first, though. How did the civil rights message become a standard in Simone's repertoire?
Well, Nina Simone was a political... being from the beginning, but then at a certain point she turns around and it's one song after another. After she has a breakthrough, and she begins to do these songs for women, young, gifted, and black, and so forth. And this one, Backlash Blues, she'd found in a collection of poems by her friend Langston Hughes. And she could hear the songfulness of it. Hughes had written songs before and may have been thinking of this as a song, but she heard it right away. And the two of them, I think, joined hands in protest together with this thing. She cared about the lyrics and that the sound of her voice is so powerful, but she makes you hear that the mean old backlash a part of it.
So another passionate voice in the struggle was bassist, pianist, and composer Charles Mingus. His Fables of Faubus protest Orville E. Faubus. He's the Arkansas governor who sent the National Guard in 1957 to Little Rock Central High School to stop the school's integration of 9 African-American teenagers. And here's a little bit of Fables of Faubus. You know, what I'm struck by is, Robert, is that this music is always, on some level, sly and it's not even a song like Strange Fruit is not just poor me music. There's something more to it. You know, what do you think jazz has brought to the whole idea of looking at social justice?
Well, I think it's a very good question. I think jazz refuses the self-pity and sentimentality of most popular American music, and there's an aggressiveness. There's a tell it like it is, truth tellers impulse in this music. The version of Fables of Faubus that you're playing doesn't get yet to the lyrics, where Mingus gets to the microphone and say, "Why are you, Faubus, why are you so sick and ridiculous?" I mean, this is not the usual. And by the way, his company refused to record it, just as Billy's had, and he had to put it on a small label, calling Eisenhower and others out. I think there is very often an overtly political message, but even when it's not overtly political, there's a been there and gone. Truth-telling, passion. Now, love is like a faucet; it turns off and on. You know, when you're talking about the love and its vagaries, but that impulse to tell the truth, I think, is what makes love, what makes the music so strong, and its aggressiveness.
Is there any of that left? Are contemporary jazz musicians, any of them, kind of lining up to do things that have an element of social protest or at least cultural observation?
Well, this is another great question. People have read jazz as being the music of democracy, the music of revolution. People of the right, the center, and the left all listen to mainly instrumental music and hear these different things. And I think it's important to make that observation. I would say that there are, that if you listen to the music of Wynton Marsalis, there's a sense of urgency. There's certainly a politics to that playing. If you listen to the music of the people who come out of the AACM in Chicago, there's definitely a politics there, a kind of insistence on the community-basedness of the music, of the freeness of the music. So I would say that even though it's hard to find any music at all on the radio dial, for people who know where to look for it, especially in big cities where jazz is to be heard, you do hear that same passionate will to tell the truth. I'm very optimistic about it. I teach jazz here at the university, and my students almost jump out of their chairs when they first hear Mingus, and then they want to play like that. They want to play for real.
Well, Robert, thank you for this incredible tour.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful.
Robert O'Mealy is the Zora Neale Hurston Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. He's also the founder and former director of the Center for Jazz Studies. It's time now for a look at sports with our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You know, I know you're not exactly a sports fan, but if you could go to London for a nice long vacation at Wimbledon, would you?
I do love watching tennis, actually.
Really?
Yes, I do.
Oh, well,
and
good for you.
Also hanging out on those double-decker buses.
Well, good for you. Well, I asked the question because that is exactly what New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden did, and he got to see one of the most exciting matches in the history of the All England Club, and now he is back. My man Bill Roden, how are you?
Great, Tony Cox.
You know what? I was going to say cheerio to you until one of our co-workers, who is British, let me know that cheerio actually means goodbye and not hello.
Yeah, no, we're not a big cheerio people. Yeah. What's going on? What's happening?
So what was it like, family vacation at Wimbledon?
Oh, man, it was tremendous, Tony. I mean, we saw a lot of Williams sisters stuff, which was phenomenal. Saw large parts of the great match between Adele and Federer, classic. I mean, it was just really, really, just really a great week of tennis. And the wonderful thing, you're on vacation, and you look at it, you know, as a columnist, you're always working, and you always have perspective on it. But it's kind of different when you're able to digest it, and and I think that while the Federer and Nadal match was just one of those great sports moments, as a sports writer, every moment like last month we had the great Tiger Woods moment. There are always going to be great moments. But I think when you look at the Williams sisters, there's not going to be I don't think there's going to be an era like that again, at least in my lifetime. I don't think we're going to ever see that soon. And
It was something to watch. And I want to talk about that with you for a moment, because mm-hmm. a lot has been written. First of all, by way of background for anybody that possibly missed it, Venus beat her younger sister Serena in the finals, and Venus now has 5 Wimbledon titles, although Serena has the edge in record head-to-head matches between the two sisters. But here's the deal. A lot has been written about how Serena took the loss. Now, what I saw, it seemed perfectly normal, even gracious, although clearly she was disappointed. But what did you see?
Oh, she was, listen, man, she is a tremendous competitor. And she, you know, she was angry. I mean, she did not want to lose that match. This was a very important match. And I think even Venus, she was going for number 5. And Serena desperately wanted to win Wimbledon. That's why that match between those two, people say that it wasn't a classic. Tony, man, there were shots that Venus had been hitting winners on all tournament long, and nobody could return them except her sister. Mm-hmm. They were hitting, these were two tights, they were hitting shots that nobody had been able to return all tournament, and they were routinely giving it back. That's why people said, well, it wasn't a classic unless it went three sets. Well, they're never going to play something that goes three sets because they know each other too well. They're too powerful. They're too athletic. I mean, to go three sets, they probably would both die.
Well, did you see anything that made you think that Serena was inappropriate? Her response to losing was more than it should have been, than what it should have been.
No, I mean, I think it was funny that her mother did. Her mother, and you know, I guess your parents were always your parents. Her mother kind of chided Serena, saying, "You know, well, you know, she's got to understand that you can't win everything, and you got to learn how to lose." And so, I think that was a mother's response, and that's why those two girls have stayed grounded all this time, because that's exactly how their parents have taught them to react. But I think as a pure competitor, I could see she was deeply disappointed. But guess what? 2 hours later, they were back playing doubles
and wiped
and
whipping
them out,
somebody going, else. Well, you know, I thought that Venus did a really good job of saying, you know, she relishes the big sister role. And, you know, I'm a big brother, and I don't know whether you are or not, but sometimes it's good to keep the little ones, you know, in their place, right?
Yeah, but what Venus did say is that I cherish the role of big sisters, but in this Wimbledon, I cherish the role of defending champion.
Absolutely. let me ask you one more thing about the finals involving the men, just really quickly. Do you think that the names Nadal and Federer now join the icons like McEnroe, Connor, Sampras, and Bjorg as the best tennis that has ever had?
Clearly, Federer and Nadal is great. I think that he needs to win a couple more, you know, Grand Slams. Not just to clay, not just to French, which he owns, but I think he needs to come back and defend his Wimbledon title. I think he needs to win the Australian. I think he needs to come here, New York, and win the U.S. Open. And that's not being harsh. It's just when you look at great people, Borg, Connors, Sampras, these are people who have won over and over and over and over again. And that's why I think winning five was so significant for Venus, because that's, to me, is the mark of greatness, is to do things, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years in a row. So I think that Nadal still has a couple more Grand Slams to win before we put him up in the pantheon.
Now, back to the sisters. We have about a minute left, a little bit under that. They are supposed to play at the tournament out here in California at Carson, which is right next door to Compton, where they grew up. But there's questions about whether they will play there or whether they will play anymore at, say, Indian Wells down near Palm Springs. Are they on the downstroke of their careers now?
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm asking you that. I
think you can't see them. You couldn't see that match and think they're on the downstroke. I think, in fact, they've got their second win.
Really?
I think Venus wants to play for another 4 or 5 years. Serena's only 26 years old. I think they've got tons of tennis in them. And then you look at the women's draw. A lot of the women are breaking down indirectly because of the Williams sisters.
Yeah, you got a good point. Well, you had a good time, right?
I had a great time.
You had some scones and all that stuff?
Scone? No, I can get that here. I had crumpets. crumpets, strawberries, and cream.
All right, we'll get together in a couple of weeks. Bill Roden, nice to have you back on American soil. Thank you.
Hey, man. Take care, Tony.
William C. Roden is a sports columnist for the New York Times and author of $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete. And he spoke with our very own Tony Cox. And now it's letter time. Our editor, Sasha Woodruff, is here with me. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How are you?
I am doing great. So what are folks saying this week?
Well, we got some comments about a story we did on a reported drop of media coverage on the war in Iraq. Charles Dern in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, wrote us this. I am amazed how the various reasons given for the reduced coverage skipped the obvious. One of your guests said that coverage switched off the same week General Petraeus said the surge was working. The obvious reason is the press is not interested in success in Iraq, especially if it made Bush look good.
Carolyn Liddell Bennett in Rochester, New York, praised us for a guest on that same segment. I don't care for much of what NPR puts on anymore, but I want you to know that I appreciate your having Laura Flanders on this evening. She is one of the intelligent voices of which there are so few on radio in broadcast news, commentary, and analysis.
We got a couple of comments on the month-long series on jazz that we're doing. Last week, we talked about how radio stations were dropping jazz from the programming lineups. Melinda Kennedy, who listens on WMUB-FM, noted this. It's not the music that keeps me from listening, but the radio personalities that host the shows.
And Don Nichols in Wildwood, Missouri, chimed in. Jazz has not suffered. Most of the greats are gone, but other than that, it is the same as it's been for decades. It is a black genre and has never made it out of that community. Should it have more exposure on the radio? Maybe, but if no one is listening, who will pay? Welcome to what makes the world go round. It's called capitalism.
And speaking of music, Kenneth Lyles in Houston, Texas, wrote in about a story we covered on our News and Views blog about a singer in Denver who sang "Lift Every Voice and Sing" instead of the Star Spangled Banner. I disagree with labeling "Lift Every Voice and Sing" as the Negro national anthem. I was taught that it was the Negro anthem. Am I wrong in thinking that there is a slight difference in the two?
Kenneth, generally the song is called the Negro National Anthem or the Black National Anthem. Finally, we turn to Lanice Bennerman in Durham, North Carolina, who wrote in about the segment called Ready to Get Married But Can't Find a Mate. She said it hit close to home. I'm one of those early 30s, never married, no kids African-American females. I make decent money, but I am by no means well off. I have had brothers tell me they can't do anything for me after finding out where I reside and what I drive. Besides economics, appearance and what's pleasing to the eye has a lot to do with marriage statistics in our community. I've been told that I was cute for a dark girl, but they prefer red bones. They like longer hair, thinner thighs, and all sorts of superficial nonsense. I think a lot of brothers have taken on the European standards of beauty.
And that's it for letters. Thank you for writing, and please keep yours coming.
To write to us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, it's called the Birthplace of Jazz. It's called the Birthplace of Jazz, but how did Hurricane Katrina affect New Orleans' artistic community? We continue our month-long series on jazz with a look at jazz in the Big Easy.